So last time, we talked about this idea of cache coherency, that if we had multiple cores, which are sharing some memory, we learned that they could all be connected to that memory simultaneously, but for speed, we want the cores to have local cache copies of the data in that memory. But this creates a problem of what if there are two different versions of the same value? We need to keep that from happening, or else we'll get really confusing results. And the strategy we used is that we enforced that at most one core had a modified value. And if that core had a modified value, no one else would have any version of that value. And the way we did this is by having all the processors connected to a shared bus for communicating with memory, meaning that you could listen in on what other people were asking to read or write from the memory, and also announcing when you were modifying a value on that shared bus, so everyone else would learn, okay, I better get rid of my copy of that value now. And by doing that, we enforced the actual criteria. Oh, I'm not projecting. No wonder people are probably confused. So we'll try, I guess we're gonna do some video editing. Okay, that makes more sense. And I'm gonna have to do some video editing to fix that later. Okay, then we talked about tools to help us implement locks on top of this. And our key tool that we were going to use was, this atomic read, modify, write operation. And the idea was that when we were keeping this value in the modified state, so no one else had it, we could have that not just read or write it, we could do something where we read and write it all at once. And this lets us actually implement locks. So we saw spin locks. We would read the old value of the lock and see if it said it wasn't taken, and write that it was taken. And in this way, we'd learn whether we set it to taken or someone else had already set it to taken at the same time as we set it to taken. So there's no opportunity for someone to sneak in and set it at the same time and us to get confused about who got the lock. And then we talked about mutexes, which were our more reasonable locks, because spin locks, what we had to do when we didn't get the lock is we tried again and again and again and again, over and over again. That's very wasteful. And instead, what we want to do is tell the operating system, hey, run something else. So to run something else, we need to have a list of things to wait for. And the strategy we used is we used the spin locks to make sure that only one thread at a time accessed that list. But once you finished manipulating that list, you could do something more efficient and tell the operating system, hey, I don't want to be running anymore, for example. So any questions about things we covered last time? Okay. Sorry for not displaying quick slides. Okay, so since there are no questions, let's try this exercise on cache coherency. So remember last time, we talked about every cache block, and in this case, our cache blocks are 32 bytes. Meaning that address 0 through 31 is in one cache block, addresses 32 through 63 are in another, and so on. And we're saying we do 8-byte reads and writes. And this is our access pattern. And I'm asking, what is the state in each of the three caches? There's three CPUs here afterwards. So I'll give you a couple minutes. You can check with your neighbor, see if you agree on the answer.
seconds of power, it writes to you.
Okay, who wants more time? Oh, well, here's anyone want to share their answers? Yeah. So you say CPU 1 should be modified, and how did you figure that?
Because when it, the third line, when it writes to 1000, no other writes to 1000.
So you're saying, okay, so it wrote to 1000, so it became modified. Wrote to 1000. Okay. And we have, yes?
I'm going to guess it's shared.
You think it's shared?
Because when CPU 2 reads 1000, the table is that the modified changes to a shared state when it hears a read on the
yeah. So the rule for modified is we are in the modified state when we have a changed value and no one else has a copy. If we want anyone else to get a copy, we can't be modified anymore. And this is necessary to maintain our most important property that no two processors disagree on what the value is. So you're right here that at when CPU 1, so I'll just step through what happens for value. So initially, CPU 1 reads it, so it becomes shared, and everyone, no one else has a copy, so they're both invalid. Then CPU 2 reads it, so it becomes shared, and because it's just reading, it doesn't, CPU 1 doesn't need to change anything. Two can be both shared, so that's fine. So they're both shared, and three is still invalid. Then when CPU 1 writes to the value, it needs to go to the modified state, and it needs to make sure CPU 2 doesn't keep an old version around. Then later on, we have CPU 2 reads from the value, and in order for CPU 2 to read the right version of the value, CPU 1 needs to send it back, send it out to the bus, and is in fact going to write it back to memory with our three states. So it can write it back to memory, so CPU 2 can read it, and it becomes shared. And so, and I think that's the last thing which affects the state. So I believe the last state of CPU 1 is going to be shared. And by the same logic, the last state of CPU 2 is going to be shared. Okay. Then we have CPU 3, and it turns out that this 1008 address is part of the same cache block as 1000. So it's going to have the exact same states. It's all part of the same thing. So when CPU 3 reads from that, it's going to set the state of the whole cache block to shared itself. So they're all going to be shared. So questions on how I figure that out? Yes.
That last part. Can you explain?
So the question is, why is 1008 and 1000 in the same cache block?
Yeah, why it becomes shared after for all of them.
So
I guess it's that last step.
So it's only since no one has a more up-to-date copy, you can get it directly from memory. So CPU 3 reads that whole block from memory, containing 1000 up to, so we have 0x1000 to 0x1000 1f is what our cache block contains, 32 bytes. So it reads that whole thing from memory, and it can do that because it's up to date.
So anything was, so if it was like, anything in that 32, if that's 0x, whatever, fell into that cache block, it'll read that entire 32.
The question is, when CPU 3 is fetching the value, it's going to get the entire thing? Yes. So the way the cache works is it has to read the entire cache block or nothing. It can't do parts. Yes?
Why do you block it? Why are the cache blocks 32? Why can't it make the same size as 32?
So the question is, why would the cache blocks be 32 bytes and not 8? Or 4, or 2, or 1, well, we have to keep track of this type of information for each cache block. So there's a real cost to doing that. So that's one reason why the cache blocks are generally going to be bigger. Another reason why is that we want to take advantage of locality in our caches. And typically, if you access two values that are at adjacent addresses, it's actually good to read them together because you're likely to read them. You know, if you access one of them, you're likely to access the other. We learned with false sharing that maybe that isn't always the case, but usually it is the case that that's a good thing to do. Yes? The question is, the reads and writes are indexed by the byte and not by the 8-byte?
Yeah, so you list the 8-bytes as being the size for reads and writes.
So, yeah, so the question is, what is the reads and writes being 8-bytes? So what's really happening here is that each of these reads is reading 8-bytes, numbered starting with 1000, then 1001, 1002, up to 1007. Or not really 1000 because it's hex, but you get the idea. Other questions? Okay, anyone want to tell me about the answer to question 2? Yeah.
Invalid, modified, invalid.
So you're saying invalid, modified, invalid. And I agree. So originally, CPU 1 gets it shared, but then CPU 2 writes to part of that whole block, which is 2000 hex to 201F hex. And to do that, it's going to have to invalidate A's copy. And I should write this in a place which makes more sense. I made a separate column for this and didn't use it. So S, and then we have I, M, I. Okay, any questions about that? Okay, and so another piece of review from last time. So we talked about atomic operations letting us do things. So here's an atomic operation, and in a real processor, this might appear, there might be like a instruction that represents this. Like there might be a CAX, REX, RBX, RCX instruction. x86 has this instruction, it's slightly different. But there's an instruction, and then here's my function that represents it. How do I implement fetch and add? And what fetch and add does is it adds to a value and returns either what it and returns the value that was just added to. But does this atomically, meaning that if two processors do it at the same time, you're not gonna, not gonna have an add be lost. Now, if they both add one to zero, you'll end up with two always. And you'll have one of them get one as the value that was there, and one of them get two. So what's my pattern to write some fetch and add function? So it's going to be fetch and add. And we're going to take like a pointer. And we're going to use this compare and swap operation to atomically add to that pointer some. And return the new value we computed, or the old value, or the previous value. So again, think about this for a bit, check with your neighbor, see if you agree. And the pattern's going to be very similar to what we did with spinlocks. Yeah. Int amount. How much to add? Yes. So fetch and add is a function you're writing using compare and swap, which is atomic. And when you're done, it used to be atomic. So you're using one atomic operation to make another atomic operation. Anyone with a sketch of an answer? Yeah.
Can they just do the statement that calls compare and swap, and then you pass in the pointer to reference it, and then if that's true, then you just return.
Okay. So your idea is that essentially what I want to do is I want to compare and swap. Pointer, and what I read at the pointer, and that plus amount, right? So I want to compute, I want to read the two values and do that. So that's essentially a strategy, and your idea is that you return if that succeeds or not?
Yeah, in a conditional.
So the idea, and I'll write this out a little more clearly. So we want to our first step is going to be we want to figure out what do we think should happen. So we get the current value, let's say, from the pointer. Then we get the expected new value, which is current plus amount. And now that we've done that, we want to change the pointer to, you know, increment it from there to there, but we want to know whether or not we lost the race, whether someone else did this first. So to do that, we're going to do a compare and swap with pointer from the current to the new. And if this doesn't work, we want to, you know, do something else. And your proposal was just to return. What we want to do instead is, like with the spin lock, we're going to try again. So go to beginning. So if it doesn't work, someone else snuck in right here and changed the value. We're going to go to the beginning. So this is the solution I have based on that. So I have a loop where I read the pointer just naively, and this might not get me the right version of the value. Someone might sneak in here and change star p. But that's okay, because if that happens, compare and swap is going to atomically try to change the value and tell me if someone snuck in there. And if they snuck in there, I redo the loop and try read the new value again and try to add to it again. I keep doing that until hopefully eventually it works. In this case, I return the old value. I could also return the new value just as easily. So this makes sense. Questions on work? So using this, I have this compare and swap, which might be an atomic operation that my processor provides. And I've used that to build something more useful for me, or maybe more useful, of this fetch and add operation, even though that wasn't an instruction my processor provided. And you'll notice this pattern we have with atomic operations that we saw in spin locks of try to do something with one of these atomic read, modify, write operations, use the read part of the operation to figure out whether that worked or not, and if it didn't, do it again. Questions about this? Okay. So when we left off last time, so these were two exercises which I probably should have done last time instead of forgetting to. But when we left off last time, we were talking about mutexes. And the idea of the mutex was that we would have a list of waiting threads, and we have a spin lock to project that. And the spin lock would just be, when I want to lock the mutex, I figure out, do I need to go to sleep while I have with the spin lock? And if so, I add myself to the list of waiting threads and go to sleep. When I unlock the mutex, I don't just set a value to it's not locked anymore. I check if someone's waiting, and if so, I do the extra work of waking them up. And in order to make sure when I check if someone's waiting that someone isn't trying to add themselves to the list of people who are waiting at the same time, I use a spin lock to make sure to protect that little period of time. So we're using this spin lock to bootstrap a more useful type of lock. So questions about this in general? People look very confused back there, so. There are some. And with spin locks, we see something where we need some help from the operating system. We need some way of doing two big operations, making a thread runnable somehow, so we need some help from the scheduler to do that, and also making ourselves not runnable and then switching to the scheduler. And a subtlety, which I think I explained a little poorly last time, is when we want to make ourselves not runnable and switch to the scheduler, we need some extra help from the OS to make sure that as we're doing that, that no one tries to, like right here, make us runnable and then start running us like on another core, which would be very confusing because where are our registers? We have two copies of them, we don't know which is right. So you need some help from the OS to do this, and in practice, most operating systems provide the assistance to let you do these, make myself not runnable and start waiting and also wake up someone who was waiting operations. And so that's mutexes. And we mentioned that pthreads has mutexes, which we saw before. So pthreads locks are mutexes. They don't just use CPU over and over again. They actually wait and run something else when you're waiting. And they're pretty efficient as long as you don't have to wait for someone else. Wait in line. If no one's waiting, if all the time there's only one person asking for the lock, they're basically half as fast as a spin lock. Because we spin lock, figure out no one's waiting, unlock to lock the mutex, and we spin lock, figure out no one was waiting, unlock to unlock the mutex. It's only in the case where we need to talk to the scheduler that things get more complicated. So questions about mutexes? Okay. So I mentioned pthread. Pthread mutexes have some additional features I'd like you to be aware of because they are useful. One of them, and many, so all of these are specified through the attributes, which we saw with thread attributes, it's similar. One thing you can do, which is probably pretty useful, is there are error checking mutexes, which will return an error from the lock and unlock functions if you do things you aren't supposed to do. The normal mutexes are just going to do something random that might not be helpful. So, worth noting about. Also, mutexes can be shared between processes. Like, that's another option they have. We won't talk about quite how to do that until we talk about how memory is managed in the operating system. Because there's an unanswered question of, well, how do I get two pointers to the same thing? Okay. Now, pthread mutexes are a little different than what you might guess they are from this. And so something people here who are being really clever might decide to do is say, oh, it doesn't actually matter if I use this as a lock. I can use this like to signal between two different threads, because I don't have to unlock from the same thread I lock from. So some people might think that's going to be a useful thing to do, and that's a reasonable thing to think, because with this implementation, there's no, I can unlock from a different thread than I lock from, and maybe that's useful. Well, pthread says, no, sorry, can't be clever. Pthreads has a rule, you have to unlock from the same thread you lock in, and the reason why is pthreads mutexes might be implemented in a slightly different way. For example, they might have that struct store the ID of the thread instead of just lock taken or not taken. So just be aware of that, even though it looks like with the implementation I showed you, it should work. It's not actually supposed to work. Okay. So now that we talked about locks, let's talk about cases where locks probably aren't good enough. And we, in fact, seen one of these. And that would be pipes. And we've learned that when you read from a pipe, it waits for someone to write to it. And this is not something we know how to do well with locks. Because like the way we know of doing this with locks is you have a buffer for the pipe, and you have a lock associated with it. You acquire the lock, you see is there anything in the buffer, you unlock, and then you acquire the lock again and check again. Like, that's the only sort of way we know how to do this with locks. And we want something better. We want that the thread which is doing the read operation doesn't keep checking over and over again. It somehow gets told by the thread which does the write operation what, when to go. And we're going to talk about, over the next few days, a whole bunch of things which are more powerful than locks that are going to let us do things like this. And in fact, we're going to have three of them. So we're going to talk about barriers, counting semaphores, and condition variables. And these are all things which are going to be implemented similar to how that mutex I showed you was implemented. That we're going to have these read, modify, write operations to do things like spin locks, and we're going to have these list of waiting threads and the add myself to the list, remove a thread from the list operations under the hood. For these, we're going to talk at a higher level, so we aren't going to go into the details of how you actually translate it to that, but it's going to be very similar to how we talked about it working for the mutex. But it's going to let us do things that we can't really do with just a mutex. Okay, so questions about this general idea of why we need more than locks?
Are they extensions like in addition to locks, or like are they used like separately?
The questions are the extensions in addition to locks. These are all things we are likely to use alongside locks. One of them, counting semaphores, will in fact be in a be a thing you can implement locks with, or like they could do strictly more than locks do. Okay, so. I'm going to talk about barriers. And to talk about barriers, I'm going to talk about another case where locks aren't good enough. So we saw when I was introducing threads this idea that we would like do something like run a thread to use the do something on the first half of the array, or run a thread to do something on the second half of the array. So one example is, let's say you want to get the minimum of a big array. A way we could do that is have one thread get a minimum of the first half, one thread get a minimum of the second half. And then take the minimum of those two minimums. But to do that, we need to somehow wait, have each thread wait for each other. And the only way we know of doing that is waiting for the whole thread to finish. Like if we want the thread to go on to like get the minimum of a different array afterwards, we don't have a way of doing that. So we're going to talk about something called barriers, which provides this wait for everyone to finish operation. And it's going to provide it, you know, similar to waiting for, you know, joining each thread, but we're going to provide it in a way where it's a little more general than that. So our barrier is going to have two operations. It's going to have an initialize operation, which takes the number of threads that we want to wait for, and a wait operation. And the idea is that everyone waits for everyone else. So rather than having like a main thread that waits for everyone, everyone's waiting for everyone else. So everyone's going to call wait, and that's going to finish once everyone has started waiting. So if we have 10 threads, when nine have called wait, those nine are going to still be waiting. When the 10th calls wait, wait returns for everybody. Yes. What happens if a thread doesn't call wait? If a thread doesn't call wait, then everyone's going to keep waiting. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
As you add a lot of threads, isn't it going to kind of slow down or like bottleneck the whole thing instead of actually speeding it up?
Question, isn't this going to slow things down? And the answer is, well, yes, it's going to be slower than not waiting. But the reason we're doing this is going to be for correctness. So with the example of our computing the partial minimums, we're waiting because we need everyone to wait for the other sums to minimums to be available before they can proceed. And this comes up a lot in sort of relation. So like our example use here is I have thread 0 computes the partial minimum, thread 1 computes its partial minimum, they both wait, and thread 0, like it wouldn't be correct to go earlier. So yes, it's going to be being slower, but it wouldn't be correct for it to go earlier than when all the other minimums are available. And barriers are a little nicer than that. They are reusable. So a common use case is that we're going to compute not just one thing, but we're going to compute a sequence of things. So this might be, for example, in like a simulation. Like if I'm simulating the weather, I'm going to divide up the world into different pieces, assign each piece to a thread, and each thread needs to know about the other pieces. So here, we compute the pieces at time 0. So thread 0 computes the piece at time 0. Thread 1 computes the piece at time 0. Then they both wait for each other, and they use the values from time 0 to compute the values at time 1. Then they both wait for each other and use the values at time 2 to compute the values at time 1 to compute the values at time 2, and so on. And this is a very common pattern in simulations, and one reason why barriers are so useful, because this comes up all the time when you're trying to use multiple threads to get more work done than you could with one. And we need this barrier in order to make sure that it's okay for thread 1 to use result 00, that it needs to know that that's actually been written. And similarly, it's okay for thread 0 to use result 01, it needs to know that's actually been written, and so on. Questions about this works? Yeah.
Do they usually get initialized globally so that all of them can see, or how does each one see the barrier?
Question is, how does each one see the barrier? That's the same sort of way how each of them would see a lock. You can pass a pointer to it however you want. There could be a global variable, that's it. You could have a pointer and something you pass to the threads. There are lots of options. We have an assignment coming up, the life assignment, next week, where we want you to use barriers. And I believe we tell you, please do not use a global. And the reason why we tell you that either directly or indirectly, we tell you, we want to call your function multiple times at the same time, so you probably shouldn't use a global. Which means you'll need to pass a pointer to it. Okay. So we have barriers. And I gave you this sort of abstracted API. The pthreads actual has barriers, and the API is very similar, slightly different, but it's what you might guess from the pattern you might saw with mutexes and starting threads. Okay. So questions on using barriers? Okay. So barriers are very useful. They do things locks can't do, but we're going to have something that's more general. And I'm going to speak of another case. I'm going to have this example of a very common problem when we're talking about multiple threads. That's where we have some threads which are producing values and some threads which are consuming values. And these threads have this shared buffer where they're putting the things they're producing or consuming. And this occurs all the time when people are writing multi-threaded code. And typically, it's the case that we don't want them to be working in lockstep. We don't want it to be the case that each producer waits for the consumer to get the next thing before it produces something. We want that buffer to be able to fill up with some slack so they don't have to be working at the exact same rate. And an example of this practically is like a C compiler. We have a preprocessor that produces stuff for the compiler. The compiler produces stuff for the assembler. We have these buffers in between those where we want to send data as it's produced and have it processed. There's other examples that come up all over the place. So we're going to talk about this example several times. And first I'm going to talk about it with some abstraction known as monitors. So monitors, we're going to take locks and we're going to add the thing that locks are missing to them. So locks handle mutual exclusion, that one person at a time accesses something. And the big something in this case is going to be this buffer. So we're going to use locks to make sure one person at a time accesses it. But what we're missing is we need some way to wait for something to happen. So the example with the pipe was we're reading, the buffer is empty, we need to wait for something to be put on the buffer. So we're going to have this new thing called a condition variable, which is just a name. It's not perhaps the best name, but it's the name you'll see everywhere. that's going to be, we're going to pair with these locks. And we're going to call the combination of a lock, some condition variables, and some shared data, like that buffer, a monitor. So in the pthreads API, these are all actually separate things. We have locks, we saw mutexes, condition variables are a separate thing, and you have to decide what is the other data that is related to the lock yourself. In some more object-oriented languages like Java, Java actually like turns every object into a monitor. So an object has data, its fields, and it also has a built-in lock and condition variable. You probably have never used it, but yes, every object in Java has a lock in it and a condition variable in it. But we're going to have them be separate. So let's talk about what a monitor sort of looks like abstractly. So a monitor, we have a lock, and we're going to have this rule when we use the monitor that before we access any of the data or condition variables in the monitor, we have to first be the one who has the lock right now. So we have to wait in line. So the lock is going to have a list of threads that are waiting for it. We also have condition variables, and each condition variable is going to have a list of threads that are waiting for something to happen. We'll have separate condition variables for different things they're waiting for. So for every type of thing we want to wait for, we'll define a condition variable, and there will be ways for threads to add themselves to that list of waiters, and ways for another thread to say, oh, you should stop waiting right now, and to remove them. So we're going to manage those list of waiting threads sort of manually. And condition variables are going to be our tool for doing that. So our condition variable is going to have three operations. So one operation is wait. And you'd think that wait only cares about the condition variable, but it cares about the condition variable and the lock. So the idea with the wait operation is that we have the lock, and we looked at the shared data and determined that we need to wait. For example, maybe the shared data is the buffer, and we said, oh, the buffer's empty right now, so I need to wait. And what the wait operation is going to do is it's going to unlock the lock and add the current thread to the list of waiting threads in the condition variable. And it's also going to get the lock back before we return. So you can think of the wait operation as putting us on this list and then running, giving the next person the lock, the next thread the lock at the same time. So it's a combination unlock and start waiting operation. Okay, questions about that? Yeah.
When you say reacquire a lock, does that mean like when it gets queued up in the condition variable?
Yes, so when another thread says you should not be waiting anymore, we're going to get the lock back before wait returns. So I'll show that when we talk about broadcast and sync. So broadcast is remove all these things that are waiting and have them stop waiting. And what that's actually going to mean is because they waited by waiting with, you know, with this wait operation, they're not going to run immediately. Instead, we're just going to add them to the locks list of waiting threads. Because the first thing they're going to do is get the lock back. So the broadcast operation just like takes the whole list of waiting threads and adds it to the list of waiting threads for the lock instead. There's also a signal operation, and the signal operation chooses any one thread waiting for that thing and puts it on the locks and has it start waiting for the lock instead. It could be the last thread that started waiting, it could be the first one. That's not actually specified. It's just an arbitrary choice depending on how the condition variables are implemented. questions about this? Okay, so let's look at an example. So here I have wait for finished and finish. So the wait for finish operation returns once someone has called finish, and the finish operation makes sure someone who wait for finish returns. And to implement this, here's our monitor. We have a lock, and we have some shared data. The shared data is, have I finished yet? And I have a condition variable for people who are waiting for me to finish. So when I wait for finished, what I do is I first acquire the lock, and I check, well, did they already finish? So I don't even need to wait. And if they didn't, I start waiting. Otherwise, I just return right away. And the finish operation, I acquire the lock before I change anything. And then I say, yep, we finished. And I make sure everyone who's waiting stops waiting. And goes on. So questions about what we see here? So note that the finish is the shared data. We never access it without acquiring the lock, ever. No exceptions. And we check first whether we wait at all. You might ask, why is there a loop there? We'll talk about that later. And we know we need to wait. And the advantage of acquiring the lock here is that, well, since we have this lock, finished is not going to change. We know it's not going to change because the only place which changes it gets the lock first. And that can't run until we start waiting. And so that's how we guarantee that there's not going to be someone sneaking in right here and changing finished to true, and then we're waiting forever. And that's why we have this lock to protect the shared data. Okay, other questions? Or any questions? Okay, so what this might look like is one example is let's say I call wait for finish before finish happens. I get the lock, I check if the finish is set. And I find out it's not, so I start waiting. At this point, that releases the lock. So the finished thread, maybe it tried to get the lock earlier. It waited for me to check that whether finished happened or not. And then it was done. And then it says finished to true. And it signals the broadcast on the condition variable. Since it broadcasts on the condition variable, that made me stop waiting and start waiting for the lock in the wait for finished thread. Now, I don't get the lock until the finished thread releases it. After that, I'm the only one waiting for it, so I'm going to get it. I check that finished is whether finished is true now. It is in fact true, so I'm done. I release the lock after checking that and finish. So this is one possible timeline. Questions on here? Another possible timeline is finish it gets called, and later on, wait for finish is called. So wait for finish never even waits. And when finish got called before anyone was waiting, it broadcast on the condition variable. No one was waiting. That's not a problem. It just doesn't do anything if no one's waiting. So questions about this? So you might have a question, so I promise I get back to you. Why the loop? Why is there a loop? We only broadcast if finish is true, so can't this just be an if statement? Because con wait's not going to finish, wake up, you know, our thread, unless someone broadcasts. And that's the only thing which could happen in that code I showed you. And the reason is something I didn't tell you about how condition variables work. So if we look in POSIX's documentation, it has this wonderful statement, spurious wake-ups may occur. And a spurious wake-up means weight returns even though nothing actually happened. You might say, why did POSIX decide to do this? Because it makes implementing cond weight easier. There are some corner cases which would be tricky to prevent spurious wake-ups. So they decided, well, often you need to double-check anyways. We'll see why. So we're just going to, you know, always have to always check. There are some other implementations which might not do this, but I don't know of any currently popular ones. So usually in condition variable, it's going to have spurious wake-ups like this. They're not going to be common, which is why they're okay, but they're going to happen. So, questions here? Okay. So, we have this example of wait for finish and finished, just waiting for something to become true. That's a really simple use of condition variables. Let's go back to our producer-consumer example. So, my producer-consumer example, I have, let's say, a buffer, and the problem I have is when I'm consuming from that buffer, I need to wait for there to be data to consume. So I have my produce function, which adds an item to the buffer, and this consume function, which removes something from the buffer, dequeues it, and returns it. But rather than just returning null if there's nothing in the buffer, we want to have it wait until something gets put on the buffer in the event that it's empty. So the way we're going to do that is in our consume function, we're going to first acquire the lock, because we're never going to touch the shared state without the lock, ever. Same thing is true in our produce function. Never going to touch it without the lock. Doesn't matter if there's only one producer, we're not going to touch it without the lock. And this is really important in practice, because if we think of how the buffer is implemented, if it's like a dynamic array, what if two different threads decide to reallocate the array? Which version wins? Well, that's not a question you want to be asking. So then, we're going to first ask if the buffer is empty. And since after we check if the buffer is empty, we'll have this loop, and we'll only exit the loop if the buffer was not empty. Not so, dq. And we know that the lock is held, so we know that no one's going to change whether the buffer is empty or not. No one else is dequeuing because we have the lock. We're the only one checking if the buffer is empty at that point in time. So there, even if multiple threads call consume at the same time, there's no problem. We're not going to be confused about whether the buffer is empty. Because what's going to happen is we're going to check if the buffer is empty, find out it's not, dequeue, now the buffer is empty. Then we're going to release the lock. Then another thread gets to go, and it checks if the buffer is empty and finds out, oh, nope, not empty. OK, so questions so far? So that's our consume side. Now, we're here, we're waiting on this condition variable I call data ready. That's the list of threads waiting for there to be data ready. And in the produce side, I have this signal operation. So remember, signal chooses any one thing which is waiting and makes it runnable. We only choose one because we know at most one thing can be dequeued. So I could also broadcast, but that's going to be slow because we're going to wake a bunch of threads up. They're going to check if the buffer's empty, and while one of them's not going to find it empty, the others are. So, questions on this code overall before I go through some like examples of how it works? Yes?
Since they're both referring to the same lock, and the same thing, if you're in the while loop, will the producer ever send the signal that it's ready?
The question is, will the producer ever send the signal that's ready?
So basically, if you're in the while loop.
So remember that con wait, what it does, it unlocks the lock while you wait. And that's very important, because indeed, if it didn't, we have a big problem. And that the producer could never actually get the lock to enqueue something. Yes, so the reason that works is because this con-wait operation releases this lock, which is why it takes it as an argument while we wait. Yes? The question is, can multiple consumers be waiting? Absolutely. So remember, the condition variable has a list of waiting threads. And we're doing the signal operation, so we're going to choose one of those and make it stop waiting. Or if there's none of them, we're not going to choose any, but we're going to choose one of them, and it's okay if there's multiple, only one's going to get to start waiting with the code I showed you. Other questions? So let's look at a timeline then. So one possible thing which could happen is the produce happens first. We're going to go through ways in which we can have different numbers of iterations of this loop. So zero iterations is produce is called first, then consume happens. So if produce is called first, produce acquires the lock, it enqueues a value, it signals. Well, there's nothing to signal, that's okay. Signal just is going to return, yep, done, and it unlocks. Then the consume happens, it locks, it checks if it's empty, it's not, so it dequeues and unlocks. So that's the simplest case. We never even call wait. We never needed to wait. So we also have the case where we have one iteration of waiting. So in this case, we lock, we see if it's empty, and we call conWait, which both unlocks and starts waiting at the same time. So while we unlock, the producer can come in, lock, enqueue, signal, which stops our waiting, but we still need to wait for the unlock to happen. Then it unlocks, so we can lock. And when we lock, we find out not empty anymore. We dequeue and unlock. So questions about this timeline, how this happens? So that's one iteration of that loop. Now there's a way of having more than one, which doesn't involve spurious wake-ups. I'm going to show you what that looks like. And it needs more than two threads. So here we have two threads consuming at the same time. And that's how we're going to do this. So what happens here is we lock, we check if it's empty, it is, so we start waiting, then the producer comes in. It locks, it enqueues, it signals, that stops us waiting, and it unlocks, and how unlucky it happens that thread 3 gets the lock and not thread 2. And since thread 3 got the lock, it checks if it's empty, it's not, it dequeues, unlocks, and returns. But meanwhile in thread 2, after it's done, we lock again, we check if it's empty, well, it still is. And this is why, like, even if we didn't have spurious wake-ups, you usually still want that loop. Because someone can sneak in there who never started waiting, it's their first time, and they got the lock instead of you, even though you were the one signaled, they got the lock first. So, questions about what happened in this scenario? This is a very, very subtle thing going on here. So basically the idea is we were now ready to run after waiting, but we didn't get to go first. Because someone else snuck in and got the lock first. And this has to do with when I talked about locks, I said it's arbitrary who gets it, someone gets the lock next, but we didn't define what order that happens in. And that's how POSIX works. POSIX says, I don't tell you what order the locks happen in. So you might say, well, this is stupid. And really, this signal operation should make sure that when it stops thread 2 from waiting, that thread 2 gets the lock next. And that is a very reasonable choice. In fact, it is the choice that monitors were originally proposed with. So those are called, or core style monitors. There's also MESA style monitors, and every implementation of monitors of which I am aware is MESA style. So it doesn't do that, I'm sorry. So you would like it to be the case, if you get signaled, you get the lock next. Sorry, that's not what the implementations do. You get the lock soon, not necessarily next. And again, this is likely, like with spurious wakeups, done because by avoiding some corner cases, it makes the implementations a lot more efficient than average, especially with multiple cores. So questions on what I just showed? This pattern here. And you can see the big problem here is the signal is not, now we stop waiting, but it didn't guarantee that we get the lock next. Yeah.
Does this cause any issues? Maybe you constantly call a signal and you constantly get pushed back behind.
So the question is there some issue with starvation here where someone could be waiting and never get to run? This is something which there aren't guarantees about. So a high-quality implementation is going to make sure Threat 2 does get to go eventually, but that's not actually required by POSIX, and that might only happen because, for example, maybe the scheduler decides you were not running for long enough or something like that. Or maybe there's randomization, like deliberate randomness, to make that happen. Yeah?
When you call pthread condition wait, do you also lock?
The question is, when does pthread wait also lock? And yes, the answer is it both unlocks before waiting and locks before waiting it, before it returns. So here, it unlocked when we started waiting and locked before it returned from pthread wait. Okay, other questions?
Why not just use broadcast if you can't control who gets the lock anyway?
So why not use broadcast instead of signal? So indeed, it is always correct to use broadcast, but if only one thread's going to be able to do something useful using signal, like at least it's going to avoid waking up extra threads. So it would be more efficient. So like in this case, if we had 100 consumers, like, at most one of them could do something useful each time we call produce. Okay. So I showed you here, this is known as unbounded buffer producer consumer, because we have a buffer that's a queue that grows as big as it needs to grow. In practice, that might be a problem. Might be a problem because we might run out of memory. And that's bad. And you saw that with pipes. The operating system for pipes did not choose that strategy. They said the pipe is only so big because I don't want to just let your process consume like all the memory because someone else can't keep up. We want to slow you down. So we can add that to this implementation. And the way to think about it is now we have two different things we want to wait for. We want to wait for new stuff to consume. We want to wait for space to put stuff that we're producing. So to do that, I'll have two condition variables. And I'll have a new condition variable for the new thing we're waiting for, which is for there to be space to put stuff. And this is going to be the opposite of what we did before. So whenever I dequeue something, now there might be space for someone waiting for space to put stuff. So I signal. And whenever I'm producing, I first wait while the buffer is full for it not to be full on that condition variable. Questions about what I did here? Okay, so And as you pointed out, you could make this a broadcast, but it's going to be slow. And the reason it would be slow is that there might be more things waking up, thinking, oh, maybe there's space in the buffer, and finding out for certain it's not if there's like 100 producers. And only one of them is going to find that. One of them is going to find the buffer's not full. Then the other one's going to go and find, all the others are going to go and find out, oh, it's full now. Too bad. Questions? Okay. Another thing we could do here is we could have just one condition variable instead of two and broadcast it all the time instead of signaling it. That would be correct because we'd just be waking someone up when the buffer either became full or empty and they'd check which one was true. So that would be correct, just slow. We'd be waking threads up a lot when it didn't matter. But we have this flexibility. You can be kind of sloppy with condition variables if you want to. Or you can do the more careful, more efficient thing of only waking one thing up and having separate conditions for each possible thing. Questions about... Yeah.
If you signal a broadcast and nothing's waiting, it's not like if something waits, it's still going to signal. So.
The question is, what happens if I signal or broadcast and no one's waiting? The signal or broadcast does nothing. But the reason that's not a problem is because before we start waiting, we check whether the thing we're waiting for has happened. So we always follow this pattern of before I start waiting, I check, is the buffer full or is the buffer empty? I don't wait if it's not, so I don't have to worry about signals or broadcasts that happened in the past. You know, helping me. I just look now, do I need to start waiting before I wait? If you don't do that, you're in trouble. So if we just assumed, oh, the buffer must be full and started waiting, well, no one's going to wake us up. So our general pattern for monitors is that we have a lock, and we wait for some condition to be true that's protected by the lock with a loop. And then after we change things, we check, well, did we make other conditions true? And if so, we broadcast or signal, depending on whether more than one thread might care about it. So like with the finished example, we wanted multiple threads to wait for something to finish. And we want to wake all of them up. With our producer-consumer example, only one thread's going to care. Do that. So that's the general pattern. You see, and you can apply this to solve any of these problems where I have some shared data and people need to wait for things to become true about that, like wait for the buffer to be full or empty, or wait for the finished value to be true, and so on. Okay. And I guess something worth noting, which isn't obvious from this, is that you could like have a list of condition variables. That is a perfectly valid thing to do. No, they don't have to just be statically defined. So like you could say, for every item in the list, we're going to wait for it to become one. And you can do that by having a condition variable for each item. And that's a perfectly fine thing to do. But in my examples, things are simpler, so I just have these global condition variables. Okay, so any questions about this pattern? So, using monitors. Rules of thumb to remember. So we have shared data. The rule is we never touch it without using the lock. And that means that we don't have to worry about whether we start waiting, that someone might have changed something about it that would change whether we would start waiting. So for the entire thing of, you know, verifying that whether we should wait or not, up to what we're going to do based on waiting, like adding to the buffer, we're going to hold the lock for that entire time, except while we're actually waiting, in which case we'll give up the lock so someone else can make our condition true. And we have condition variables. Like ideally, we divide the reasons we wait into different reasons, like we're waiting for the buffer to be full or be empty. We'll have separate condition variables for each one, but we could combine it and be sloppy. And we always write a loop when we wait, and the loop is saying, do we need to wait still? If so, wait. That's our loop. While we need to wait, wait. And we have to be very careful, and this is like probably the place where you have the most bugs that are hard to figure out with condition variable code, is every time we change the thing people might be waiting for, we have to signal or broadcast on the appropriate condition variable. We have to figure that out ourselves. So like with our buffer, we need to figure out, when must the buffer become at full? We have to handle all those cases. When does the buffer become not full? We have to handle all those cases and signal or broadcast. Or when does the buffer become not empty? We have to find all those cases and signal or broadcast. In that code I showed you, that was pretty simple because there were only two candidates and one of them was easy to eliminate because it can't become full if we're dequeuing. It can't become not full if we're in queuing, and it can't become not empty if we're in queuing. You know, so we could easily eliminate one or the other. That's not always true in practice. And something about condition variables is that they allow you a certain amount of sloppiness. So there's this signal operation where the idea is often, like with the producer consumer, only one thread's going to be able to go. If you're uncertain as to whether that's going to work or not, you can always use broadcast, and it's fine because you've written the code which checks the condition again anyways. So if you woke up more threads than you were supposed to, it's not a problem. And also because that condition is checked, if you're like, I'm not sure whether I changed this or not, you could just broadcast all the time. It might be slow, but you know, if it's hard to figure out whether it changed, you can just do that, and that's fine. And similarly, you can just use one condition variable for multiple conditions as long as you remember to broadcast on it when that might have changed. Any of those conditions might have changed. Okay. And let's see. So we'll do this exercise here. So I want to do consume 2, which is like consume, but it gets 2 items. What do I change? So it gets 2 items all at once. So if there's 2 calls to consume 2, one of them gets 2 items, the other gets 0 if there's exactly two things. Like I don't want like half and half. So your idea is add another condition variable, okay. And how would we use that?
I guess say produce, if the buffer isn't empty and then we enqueue something, then we would send the signal for making the 2 ready. We would signal 2 ready if we enqueued something and the queue wasn't empty in the first place, because that's there.
Okay, so your idea is we check the size of the queue and we signal. So signal here, at least sometimes, and how would we wait for it?
Why would we wait for it?
How would we wait for it?
In consume, it's just while buffer is less than 2 elements, I guess.
Yes, buffer.size is less than 2. I don't think you actually, we could reuse the same condition variable hypothetically, and just make this into, there's only consume 2, or we could just make this into a broadcast. But that's the key idea, is we want to, every time we produce, where we might have made, now there might be 2 items to get, we signal. That's more often than we might need to, but that's not a problem. We could be a little more clever and do it less often. And we check if the size is less than 2 on the same thing. If we had both consume 2 and consume, we need to change the signal to a broadcast because sometimes we want to make sure if there's a consume waiting and a consume 2 waiting that the consume 2 doesn't wake up, say, oh, there's not two items, and then the consume never wakes up. And the easiest way to avoid that is just always broadcast. There might be more clever ways of avoiding that that are faster. We'll think about that maybe next week.